You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you look for it, every day has cause for celebration. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, baby wedding, life thing. Celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. It's no easy feat, especially if it's a big couch. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2023, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's DRIZLY.com and get your favorite drinks delivered today.
Hey guys, this is Doug Aldrich with the Dead Daisies, and you're listening to Cobras in Fire, and rock is not dead.
You're listening to the Cobras in Fire podcast, featuring special guests from Lynch Mob, Dokken, and now Dirty Shirley, guitarist George Lynch. And from Revolution Saints and the Dead Daisies, we have another guitar player, Doug Aldrich.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire.
What,
do you want to go?
How about? I don't care.
What?
Yeah. What? You want to go? I want to go.
Let's just say what we got going on here. What's up, Luz?
What's up, Baco?
We got some interviews today, man.
Double shot interviews.
Kind of a Frontiers Records promo pack here.
So, yeah, man, why don't you tell the people how this came about?
We have a couple interviews today. The first one is from George Lynch, who has a new project coming out on Frontiers Records called Dirty Shirley.
Dirty.
In this interview, I can expose that he talks about why he finally decided to take on a side project.
yeah.
Doug Aldrich, of course, he's with his big project, the Dead Daisies, but he's also in the Revolution Saints. They too have a record coming out on January 24th from Frontiers Records. But the opportunity to talk to both these guys came up, and it's kind of neat how we ended up putting it together. I took the George Lynch one, and you took Doug, and we were recording, you know, almost one after the other. It was right around the same time we were doing it in different time zones.
Yeah, man, that was the most challenging part is figuring out how Pacific Standard Time works.
It really was.
but yeah, man,
or 8 a.m. that I'm interviewing George.
Yeah, it was good that we all figured it out. But no, as soon as mine was done, yours was done, and we're like, yeah, we're done. So we've never done a dual interview at pretty much the same time, overlapping with two different artists, but.
No, that's pretty cool.
Lynch is up first on this episode. Mm-hmm. What's kind of some highlights or some things that you covered?
Well, we obviously get into the new record, but we talk a little bit of Lynch Mob, his off and again and on again relationship with Oney Logan over the years, a Mick Brown update.
Why else like that?
his relationship with Don, and of course the Lynch Mob docking his tour in the summer. So we get into that a little bit. And yeah, it's pretty good. I think people like it. What about Doug? What can the people expect from the Doug Aldrich interview?
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but also just to throw it to you. Now, this is basically between Lynch and Jakey Lee. Is there any other guitar heroes from the 80s that were kind of your inspiration?
No, that's 1A and 1B for me. I mean, there's a lot of guitar players that I liked a lot. I mean, Eddie Van Halen's kind of like a god to me, but I wouldn't consider much of a he wasn't a guy that I drew a lot of inspiration from. He was more like – it's almost like he's more like Michael Jordan, like I could never do that. So,
right.
But, you know, there's a lot of really, you know, talented guitar players from that time, but these were my guys. So yeah, this was kind of big for me.
Yeah, exactly. 1 and 2 done. Who knew? Would you have the young Baco? Could you have ever imagined interviewing both of these guys?
Yeah, I went back in time, told him he ran into the closet and started jerking off right away.
Oh my God!
I'm
All
not
right,
sure what
so...
he what he what what he used for inspiration, but he got horny.
I'm not sure how to transition from
well,
that.
How
but
about
anyway,
you, Doug Aldrich? He was, if you went back to 15-year-old Loose Cannon and said, I'm going to be interviewing Doug Aldrich in my mid to late 40s.
I would have said, at the time I would have said who, because he was in the band Lion, yeah. Not the white version
right.
Back in the time. But no, in all due respect, Doug Aldrich, guitarist, Doug Aldrich, super cool, nice guy. And he, for those, here's a little bit of his – is basically his resume, and that is he's been in Dio, he's been in Whitesnake, he currently is part of the musical collective The Dead Daisies, and his side project, which he actually refers to it as, Revolution Saints, has a new album this month as well. So, and that album is called Rise. Now, I will just say that the highlights for me on this was really getting down to what the hell is a musical collective, because Dead Daisies is run by this like multimillionaire named Dave Lowe. And he gets into that. He talks about pretty much if he agrees with the term hired gun. And it just bounces around his career with some pretty in-depth, engaging stories throughout his career.
Right on. Yeah, I loved it. I think he did a great job. So I think the people are going to dig that too. Doug has quite a fascinating career. And you're right. You know, he knows how to give an answer to an interview too. I think you had 2 questions total in over 40 minutes. So.
At one point. I think I had 5.
Yeah, no, I kid, of course. No, Doug was great, man.
Yeah, so you want to get into this or what?
Yeah, let's give the people what they want, which isn't us. So,
here is the first Cobra Double Shot interview, and that is George Lynch and Doug Aldrich.
I'd like to welcome to the program George Lynch, of course, from Dokken and Lynch Mob. How you doing, George?
Just rolled out of bed. It's not normal for me. I'm usually an early riser, but I had a clinic last night in San Diego. I live in Los Angeles, northern Los Angeles, so it was a 4.5-hour drive each way.
Okay.
And 4 of us went down from ESP and left at noon and didn't get back till 3 in the morning.
All right. Well,
an hour of music and 8 hours of driving. So I didn't roll out of bed on time. So I'm playing catch up here with you, and I apologize. But
no problem. It's a lot like being on tour: 1 hour of performance and 8 hours in the car.
Yeah, that's what I tell people when we play places. I was like, You don't pay us to play. That's the easy part.
Yeah.
It's the travel. You pay us to get here.
No doubt. Well, you never seem to be short of anything going on, obviously. Dirty Shirley, your latest effort, comes out on the 24th of January here. Plus, I see that Lynch Mob is going to tour with Doc in the summer. Do we know who's going to be singing with Lynch Mob?
Oni.
He's back.
Yes.
Okay. You know, touch on that just real quick. He's in and out a lot, but he keeps coming back, so I assume it's never really on bad terms?
Eh, you know, not bad. I mean, you know, it's just, I'm just sort of like, we operate that differently. I'm more of a, and I'm not saying one way is good or bad or right or wrong. I'm more of a just, you know, roll up my sleeves and get the work done and do it efficiently and cost effectively and Oni's more of a kind of like a 70s guy, you know, where he's just a free floating and, you know, like a hippie and just kind of, oh, you know, take our time and do, you know, get some inspiration and we'll see what happens and play with life and have party and have fun and all this and that. I'm like, okay, but, you know, so that creates conflict sometimes, you know. We sometimes agree just to step back, you know.
Okay.
But it's never anything volatile or anything too weird. It's just kind of like, I'm going to try something different this time around. For instance, on the new Lynch Mob record that I'm working on, Oni's not singing on it. I've got Joe Retta.
He hasn't. That's not a name I'm familiar with. He hasn't been on any of the other records, has he?
No, I have never worked with him before, other than an independent project that I did with someone. He was the singer on a song that I wrote and played on.
Okay.
But it has not been released yet. But he's wonderful. I mean, he's in the Oni world. I mean, he's, you know, very bluesy, very soulful. You know, he comes from that, you know, that cut from that Al Green, Paul Rogers mode, you know. Aretha, you know, all the great blues, soul singers, you know. He's fantastic. He's really, really good.
Any idea when that would be coming out? Or?
I'm going to put it at early summer.
Okay, so 2020.
Yeah, that's a kind of a, you know, just a rough stab. You know, it could be later, but right now it's looking like... you know, the record's all written and recorded as far as the music, you know, and it's just in Joe's hands at this point, working on the vocals.
Okay.
Then it'll go to mix and, you know, it's a couple months process.
The Lynch Mob Doc and Tour is going to be a fun one for the fans. Do you anticipate performing any songs with Don?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of the plan is for me to go out at the end of the night and do four songs.
Okay.
And, you know, obviously Lynch Mob isn't going to be doing any Dokken songs in our set, which we normally do quite a few.
Sure.
It's going to be just a straight Lynch Mob set, and then Don comes out and does his Dokken thing, and then I come out at the end of the night and, you know, we could kiss and hug and make up and everybody... You know, it's a love.
Well, I remember you guys were on that metal show together, and it seemed like you were kind of teasing that a reunion was somewhat imminent at that time. But if I recall, if memory serves me right, that you were a little less committal than Don. Do I have that? Am I remembering that right? Didn't you guys kind of tease a reunion that never really came to fruition on the metal show?
If I'm remembering correctly, I think, right. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry, because we've done that a number of times, and I think there's probably a little bit of some elements of the band that feel like it's the second coming of Jesus, and it's really not that.
So I got you.
We're having inflated, you know, perception of how important this is to the universe. It's not really that critically important, so be realistic. So, you know, anyway. So what we did, obviously, do something, a very kind of a, it was kind of a reunion light, I guess.
That Japan, you know, tour?
We went to Japan, and we did the South Dakota show. We put out the record with a new song. So
that South Dakota show was kind of a warm-up, correct?
Yes.
Was Ron Keel there?
Yes, he was. He I guess he was working with the promoter.
Yeah, no, he lives there too still. But you know, just a couple things in the docking thing. On the this is a more of a nerd question, but that Under Lock and Key album cover, you know, it has that kind of like cutout docking logo. Does anybody own that? Is that like, was that a prop made just for the photo shoot, or did someone, did Don take it home, put it in his garage?
Hmm.
Or do you have it?
I wish I had it. That'd be awesome. Put it on my over my front porch.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't have any idea. I don't know if that was even a real thing.
Okay. Also, well, I guess, you don't remember the photo shoot, huh?
I remember the photo shoot because there was an argument within the band about, and the management, as far as wearing those dumbass costumes, but I was not wanting to do that. I was kind of kicking and screaming, and finally the manager, Cliff Bernstein, called me up and said, George, you're going to wear the fucking costume. Shut the fuck up and just go get down there and do the photo shoot. And he was like that, you know.
Yeah.
When Cliff said jump, you just said how high. So, okay. But I was of the opinion that, you know, we shouldn't be dressing up in silly suits and shit like that, you know. Everybody have a different color and, you know, look like the same outfit that Motley Crue had and Rat had and Judas Priest had, you know, because the same guy made all the stuff.
Right? Oh, really?
And they were obscenely expensive, and I didn't think it would stand the test of time, but oh well. It actually did, though. I think he was right. You know, it was pretty cool.
All right. You used to wear, I think it was red, might have been green, but a t-shirt that just said balls on it. Where can I get one of those? I always wanted it.
You want to take that question out of context? Where can I get balls? I don't know. I mean,
was that a brand or what was it?
What was it?
Yeah,
I have no idea. I mean, you know,
you just liked wearing a shirt that said balls. I loved it. I'm, don't get me wrong. I'm not.
I don't know. Sometimes when you do drugs, you do stupid shit.
Oh, okay.
What can I tell you?
I don't know. I thought it was cool. I wanted one. I thought, you know, rocking around my farm town, but.
I think just having to, you know, I just have sort of a tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic sense of humor. So, and I like just doing stuff that's just a little slightly thought-provoking and funny. So, you know, you can usually convey a little entertaining, quirky message when you're whatever you're wearing. You know, why not?
You know? Do you still have it?
No.
You know, on you seem to have softened on your stance towards doing stuff with Don over the years. Was there some kind of formal arrangement, or just basically just time healing all wounds? I suppose I don't know how to phrase that better, but you know, you guys have definitely had your issues with each other.
Well, you know, to be very honest, I mean, our bottom line issues were always really business issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've all been around the block a bunch of times now, and we're, so, you know, as far as personally, we're fine. You know, we enjoy each other's company. We can hang out. We're good on stage. It's fine. We can write, we can work together, but it's just, you know, the business has to be right.
Okay.
It has to be fair.
Well, you would think so, but. And what's going on? Could you have any news on Mick? I know he just kind of, is he actually just retired?
I think he took a chunk of time off with the intention of coming back.
Okay.
You know, but he had to heal his psyche and his body. And, you know, I mean, drumming is hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, everybody's getting older, you know?
Yeah. And he's a hard hitter. He's been doing that for how many decades? And, you know, and it's not like, you know, some drummers that are machines like that, you know, they, Kenny Aronoff or somebody, you know, they work out and they do karate and kung fu and they stretch and they have this really disciplined life and this diet and don't drink and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And Mick's not one of those kind of people. So, you know, it was really taking a toll on him. And he was just hurting everywhere, you know, and he had a few scary episodes and, they were wake-up calls, you know. So it was like, okay, yeah. And he did something dramatic and drastic, which I think was probably what he needed to do. And from what I've heard, he's looking great now, you know. So
We're good.
Is healing up and looking fantastic, looking a lot younger and got a lot more energy. I'm a mixing old friend, and I want to see him happy and be enjoying himself. And it seems like he's gotten back to that place now, which is very, very important. So what's the point if you're not enjoying yourself?
All right, yeah, no doubt.
Serving somebody else's agenda.
Hey, do you remember a feature that was done on you? It was either in Guitar World or like Guitar for the Practicing Musicians. It kind of showed some of your tricks, and one of them was that you were using like a can opener on a Les Paul for a whammy bar. Do you remember that at all? I remember.
Really?
It was like, and I tried to do it. Like the picture didn't really explain it very well. I was kind of curious how it would even work. Yeah, you had like one of those old school can openers that was pried in there, and they kind of described what you were doing.
I have no recollection of that, and I think that it had to be a joke.
Yeah, I wonder. Well, I mean, I was young and naive. I mean, it really could have just been a tongue-in-cheek thing that I just didn't get. But
I think maybe it was a reaction or response to like some other guitar players, like Gilbert and Van Halen, were doing the thing with power tools and stuff like that. So I thought, okay, well, I'll do that, but in a more primitive fashion, just to make fun of that, you know. Yeah. Now, I don't know, vice grips, like I don't know.
But I like it.
I'm just guessing because I don't remember. That might just been kind of spur of the moment. Oh, let's grab this can opener over here and say something funny about it.
Well, Michael Sweet, who obviously you know very well, he's been on the show a few times. He's a guy who likes to keep busy like you too. I really, really dug, and a lot of people did, the first Sweet and Lynch tour. You guys never managed to put out a live show or even like a little short tour or anything.
Well, you know, with those projects, it comes down to logistics and financial viability.
Mm-hmm.
As far as being able to get it out there on the road. Because, you know, you can't just pick up and go out and go do shows. You know, we've been, for instance, KXM and some of my other projects have been offered things like that. You know, we put out a record, somebody gets excited, you know, a promoter calls or somebody and say, you know, we'll pay X amount of money to come out and do, Rock on the Range, for instance. Mm-hmm. KXM offered Rock on the Range and something in Japan or this and that. And, you know, there were good money and everything, but it was like, okay, but think about it. We have to build a crew. We have to make sure all of our schedules are cleared, which is Lynch Mob, King's X, Korn, and all the other things we're involved in. So we have to find a spot that we're all mutually able to free up, which is almost impossible. Because we're all doing 10 different things.
Yeah.
And then we have to come from, you know, three parts of the country to get together, build a crew, put everybody up, get into a rehearsal situation. And then we have to relearn all these songs that we've never really played because we created them in the studio.
Okay.
Each song is created in one day, every 2 years doing a record. So we got a period of time of 6 years that we wrote 35 songs, and we've got to pull 12 songs out of there. And go, okay, do we remember how we played these? No, nobody remembers anything. So we got to pick these things apart, dissect them, and internalize them and get that muscle memory back and learn these things like we've been playing them all our life. That's not easy to do because they're not easy songs. They're kind of complex. You know, a lot of them are complex and hard to figure out, hard to perform. So that's a lot of prep work, and that takes a lot of time and money. So you talk about maybe 10 days of rehearsal. Okay, so that's with travel, that's 12 days. That's 2 weeks right there.
Okay.
Okay, now you got to go out. Okay, let's say you got this one offer. Okay, that's not going to cover that 2 weeks of time that you just spent renting a studio and flying people in, putting people up in hotels and rental cars and pay your commissions and your crew and your time. You know, you just spent 2 weeks of which you weren't doing something else. That's half a month and you're not making any money. So then you go, you do your one show. Well, that just paid, babe, if you're lucky, all the expenses for that. So now you have to add other shows. But what's the chances of getting a hold of an agent saying, okay, we have this one anchor date. We need to build around it. Now you got to find promoters that are willing to book shows on weekdays with a band that nobody really knows around that one anchor show. And no days off because days off cost you thousands of dollars. So you got to, you know, what's the chances of that happening? This is very difficult to pull off.
That's a pretty detailed answer.
for a lot of different reasons, which I won't get into, but it gets much deeper than that. And we've had three or four failed attempts with KXM to try to pull this off. And we got very close. We got very close for 2019, and that was yanked out from under us at the last minute. But we were about ready to go out and do a winter 2019 run. We almost had it figured out, and we had the dates. Dates were being booked and so forth, and time was cut out, and something happened, and we were able to pull it off. But it's very challenging. So that's with KXM, where there is somewhat of a demand for, among some people to see that succeed and get out there and tour it. But with Sweet and Lynch, you know, it's a little bit harder sell, a little bit even more challenging, because they're like, well, why don't I just go out and do Lynch Mob?
Okay.
Because you're playing for the same promoters, the same crowd, but it's almost, why do this? You know, I mean, you know, KXM is different because it's a different thing, you know. But for some of these projects that I do, which is almost kind of Lynch Mobby, but just with a different singer, you know. So it's like, okay, well, sort of redundant, you know.
Does it ever make you reconsider doing so many different projects?
Well, I always know it's the wrong thing to do, but I do it anyways because I like to.
Okay.
I like to write. I love being in the studio, and I love playing with other people and making what I think are interesting, fun records that matter a little bit to some people. And I would really just stay. I'm a studio creature. I would just stay in the studio forever and never leave.
All right, well, nothing wrong with that if that's where your heart is at. You know, you have really done a lot of different types of projects too. I mean. Well, shit, your the Lynch Mob, the rap metal one, the Smoke and Mirrors.
Oh, yeah, Smoke This, yeah.
You know, I saw that tour. You guys did come through the Twin Cities here. That was a real big step out of the box, especially for Lynch Mob. Did you ever think about calling it something else? I know you've joked that people have said it's Lynch Biscuit, but...
Right, well, again, the dilemma with that was, yes, absolutely, was never expecting to call it Lynch Mob, because it wasn't. But it was the only way I could sell the project to a label, and they insisted on it. And they go, well, you can call it something else and put it out and sell it out of the back, you know, the trunk of your car, or you can call it Lynch Mob and have a record deal. Put a gun to my head. What am I going to do?
That three-song EP, how do you pronounce it? That Syzygy. Is that a word that, what does it mean? Is it made up? Or?
The astral alignment of three common celestial bodies along a common axis, exerting a compound gravitational force on a fourth object.
Sounds like you've been asked that question before.
I used to read the dictionary.
Oh, man, you had that right off the top of your head. That's pretty impressive, man.
Yeah. It's actually in some New Age circles, it's considered a thing that affects us and can affect us in some ways. It's otherwise known as the harmonic convergence when that event occurs. And... feeding off that, I came up with a project which I never actually finished, but it was actually Jeff Pilson and I's one of our joke projects. And we called the band the Harmonica Virgins. And we're kind of a Lilith Fair lesbian new age band. And, you know, it's a play on words with the Harmonica Virgins and the Harmonica Virgins. So, anyways.
That is a deep pun.
Yes. Thank you.
Well done. Before we get into Dirty Shirley, I did want to ask you, you're not, over the years, you know, following your career, you haven't really been known as someone to get into a lot of political discussions in your music or just in interviews and stuff, but you haven't really held back on the most recent administration by some of the quotes I've seen out there. Why the sudden change? Why get out there now, I guess?
It hasn't been a sudden change for me. I've been a political animal for...
I meant outwardly as an artist, you know. I mean, I haven't really seen it in your music much or in interviews.
Yeah, you got to be careful with interviews. You know, you can alienate people, mm-hmm. but you can't be afraid to say what's truthful and important. And you know, if you have an audience, that you give a responsibility. Even if you don't, everyone has a responsibility to be a participant in the process. And to be aware and to, you know, edify and educate themselves as to what the truth is, so we can base our decisions based on something rational rather than, you know, information. So, I have been an environmental active and politically active person for most of my adult life. And it's been a very challenging thing for me to incorporate my worldview into my music because mm-hmm. I'm not a singer, and for the most part, not a very good lyricist. As, you know, being a lyricist is being a poet, ideally, and I'm struggle with that. I'm not a natural poet.
Okay.
Like all, or and other people I work with, like London, you know, but I just have, you know, play with words like an instrument. So, but I have been profoundly committed to, you know, pursuing the truth and doing what I can do in my small way to make the world a more just and fair place. So I'm very progressive in my politics, very liberal, and have been very active in environmental circles. On a musical level, it's been challenging for me to incorporate those ideas into my music because, as I said, I'm not the one delivering the message, you know.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, in other words, if I work with a singer that doesn't feel like I do about things, you know, what am I going to do? Ask them to say something that they don't believe, sing about something that they don't believe?
No, that's valid. You know,
Doug is more of a libertarian on lots of issues, Doug Pinnock. So, you know, he'll write songs about, you know, gun rights, which I completely, absolutely oppose. But I have to get up there and, you know, I'm part of the process. Okay, we're doing a video for a song called Gunfight, where he's holding an AR-15 talking about, you know, they're coming to take our guns. I'm like, what? Oh, Jesus. You know, and that's not me, you know, so I have a problem with that. But, you know, I understand people have different viewpoints, but try not to be calcified in my opinions. And I can be convinced that, you know, I know I don't know everything. And so I'm open to, you know, being a free thinker. I would like to improve on my stances if I'm wrong. So, but there was one record that I did that I was actually very passionately involved in the writing. I wrote almost, I probably wrote 75% of the lyrics on the Shadow Train record.
Okay.
Just not a record that, you know, garnered a lot of attention, but it was the soundtrack to the film that I worked on, Shadow Nation. And I actually came up with all of again, a majority of the vocal melodies and lyrics. And I don't know where it came from, but I was just, you know, very agitated and motivated, and I gave a shit, and it came from the right place. You know, I just couldn't stop. It was just, you know, and that hasn't happened before or since on any record I've worked on. So the problem is I just can't sing very well. So I get very frustrated in my head. I'm Aretha Franklin. And then as soon as I open my mouth, I'm, you know, something else, a frog. So it's very frustrating, but I do hear it in my head.
Right.
And being able to get that idea across and get it to a real singer, sometimes we have good results. But and that happened in that case on that record.
Well, let's get to Dirty Shirley. It comes out on January 24th on Frontier Records. Was the name it just kind of taken from the drink, or is there a story behind that?
Oh, just sitting around, looking around the studio. We need a name for the band. I'm thinking, why do we beat ourselves up? You know, the thing is, I do all these projects over the decades, and like we come up with these dumbass names that are initials, and you know, the least creative, lowest common denominator. Nominator choice you could possibly imagine, you know, nothing cool, nothing anything, no vibe to it. It's like KXM or TNN or, you know, Sweet and Lynch. I'm like, oh Jesus God, can't we do better than this? So I'm like just name it anything. And I was just looking around. I had this wall of amplifiers, and one of them was a Friedman Dirty Shirley. I could call it that.
All right.
And I'm joking, but I submitted that name to the singer and the label, along with two other names, and that's the one they picked, not knowing it was an amplifier.
Oh, okay. I didn't know it was an amplifier. I've heard of the drink, but that was it.
Oh, I didn't know about the drink. Yeah.
I love the record, by the way. I listened to it a couple times this week, getting ready for this. It's a little different. I kind of see it has a lot of Lynch Mob vibe to it, but it's almost got a little bit of a Dream Theater, and I don't know, hopefully I don't piss people off. A little bit of Led Zeppelin, maybe?
Yeah, it's got all that. I mean, all my records have a little bit of all that. I don't know about Dream Theater. I'd say a little bit of Evanescence in there.
Okay, well, yeah, fair enough. The songs are kind of epic. There's a lot of long tracks on here.
Yeah, there's that, you know. I'm really bad at self-restraint. You know, some of these people I work with, they're like, well, you know, could you leave some more holes in the music, or do you ever breathe? And you know, like silence is a note, and I've got to learn that. I'm still trying to learn that lesson. It's very dense and very, you know, epic and, you know, sort of, you know, hey, what happened to a 3.5-minute song, you know?
Yeah. No, it's all good with me, man. If it works, it works. And it definitely did on this album.
Self-indulgent was the word I was looking for. It seems like overly self-indulgent. I apologize for that.
It didn't come across that way, but the second half is really strong, honestly. Siren Song, Voice of a Soul, Cold and Escalator. These are all killer tracks, man.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we being older guys, we're sort of building these albums like people are dropping a needle. You know, we'll never get over that. You know, that's the way I imagine people are listening, even though they're not. So try to build it, try to lay out a record so that it builds.
And you got the video out there for Here Comes the King. You're embracing the gray, I see, George.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to the point where just, it was disingenuous to, you know, I saw a picture. It was on, I saw some picture on Instagram or something of some band, you know, our age guys, all people we know. And I looked at this picture and they were kind of lined up. And I went, every one of these guys is wearing a wig. This guy, they're all dyed. And I go, it looks so artificial. You can tell their faces that there's nothing wrong with getting older. Why not? You know? And so I think, you know, fuck this. It's starting to look silly. You know,
specifically, who are you talking about in those pictures?
Oh, it's all of us, including me. Yeah, in my recent past, you know, I was like, wait a minute, that's obvious.
Oh man, the guitar tone. No, every record you've ever done, it you can definitely has that George Lynch sound. This one though, the guitar tone itself is I would describe it more dirty than distorted.
I think I was. You know, there's a lot of variety on the record as far as guitar tones. So I, you know, there were points that I was going for something that was a little more wall of sound, thicker, heavier, and sometimes more way backed off, you know, just jelly through a cut little combo, you know, tweet or something, you know, and just try to paint different tapestries and, you know, have a sonic complex, you know, creating more sonic complexity and make it interesting. And serving the song, because there's a wide variety of styles on the record. So
yeah,
maybe one guitar sound for all the songs, you know, so everything got changed up in every song.
Do you have a favorite track on the album?
No, I just,
come on.
I like a lot of things about a lot of the songs. And, I would say I have some personal misgivings about certain aspects of proportions of all the songs, you know, that I didn't feel maybe, you know, I didn't quite evolve the composition to, you know, finishing it where it was, I could put a bow on it and say, okay, this is perfect. You know?
Sure. Well, how about from your career? Is there a record that you're most proud of?
I would say just generally without thinking too hard about it. Wicked Sensation.
Nice.
Because everything just sort of came together on that one by design and by luck. And, you know, we seem to be firing all cylinders on that one, where the writing just came together very organically. The chemistry was magic. We had the wind at our backs with the whole, you know, docking, post-docking machine energy and fan base. It was, you know, we were at the right place at the right time, and we had the resources. You know, did the best record we could possibly do.
Yeah, it's a killer album.
And then on another note, in another way, kind of a very underserved attempt at something I did was called Stonehouse. That was in the, I believe, the late 90s. And it was an EP I did with Matt from Saigon Kick, the singer from Saigon Kick. And we were kind of holed up. We were holed up in a barn in Northern California out in the mountains and the hills there. And we built a studio and did this very organic kind of trippy thing. It was just kind of Bowie-esque, and it's got all these other kind of elements. Really a departure. Similar like Smoke This, where, well, that was kind of the rap metal thing. This was mm-hmm. something else, you know. And very valid, and I loved that record. And it never really, I don't think we actually commercially released it, but that was something I was very proud of. I was just listening to that recently and forgotten about it. I think they're re-releasing that, actually. So.
Cool. I'll definitely be looking for that. When was the last time what was the last record you would have recorded kind of that all in the studio together kind of setting?
KXM.
Okay. So fairly recently then. That's cool.
Yeah. KXM is always, we just get in the studio and we go nuts. We write. We don't have any preconceived ideas. We just write at the moment.
Cool.
And every day we have to write and record one song. And we got 12 days.
Do you like kind of this modern advantage where you can use technology and you can all record separately? Or is it just kind of like that's what you do because it's kind of how it has to be, but you prefer everybody together?
Well, it's whether you like it or not is really moot because it is.
Yeah.
I mean, we do it because we can, you know. I mean, the Dirty Shirley record wouldn't exist if we weren't able to use that.
Sweet and Lynch too, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Sweet Lynch was done more like a band, except for me.
Oh.
Michael, Brian, and the bass player, Lomenzo, they were all in our studio back east.
Right.
Yeah, so they worked together, and it was almost a band record, yeah, done in a more traditional sense.
Kind of a joke question. Have you ever turned down anything Frontiers, I think it's Serafino, has offered you?
I don't remember. There's been some offers. I mean, they weren't projects. They were just deals that I just felt weren't, it wasn't worthwhile.
Okay.
You know, on a business level to pursue. It was too much work for too little returns kind of deal. But, you know, not because it wasn't interesting to do, or not because I didn't want to do it musically. No, never for that reason.
Well, hey, man, like I told you when we first got on, this was a pretty big honor for me. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk on all this stuff. Honestly, I when I started prepping for this, I realized I was going to get out of control if I didn't try to, well, you said self kind of, what was the term you used? I had to dial myself back, basically.
Yeah. So, right. Not to be too self-indulgent.
Self-indulgent, yeah. I mean, I was just like, there's... I would love to have you back on sometime because there's not a really, I haven't really tapped into maybe even a portion of what I really want to get into your career, but you're a fascinating dude. I love your music. Any parting shots?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, at my age, the only thing I could say is that, you know, you at this point is, you know, I just hope that I'm able to say something that matters. And not for my benefit or because it's me, but just because why the fuck was I put on this earth if I can't do something that matters? So I'd like to think that I'm doing something that's for the good, you know, and, you know, I give a shit. That's why I do what I do.
Cool.
And, you know, I do take it personal a lot of times when I miss the mark. You know, it hurts because I feel like I've let people down. You know? So every record I do, like this Dirty Shirley record, is an attempt to, you know, get it right. Well, which I probably never will. But
I think you got it right in this one. I pre-ordered it last night.
All right, appreciate the time.
Yeah. All right. Good luck with the Lynch Mob record and tour coming up this summer with Doc, and people look out for dates on that. And talk to you later, George.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
This is LC at Cobras and Fire, and I am talking today with Doug Aldrich. How are you, sir?
Great. I'm doing great.
Yeah, so just to start off, Now, the Revolution Saints have a new album, Rise, that is coming out on what date?
Revolution Saints comes out, I believe it's January 24th. It comes out.
Okay.
But you have to double check with Frontiers Music on that one, if you would. Okay. And yeah, so we're excited to get that out there to the people, and hopefully, you know, people will enjoy it.
Just a quick comments. The first two tracks that jumped out at me are the title track Rise and Higher. So I was able to listen to a stream first. Now, is there, obviously, you know, you always like all the songs that you write, but if you're going to give like another track or two to feature to get people, you know, into the album, is there any other tracks you'd say is kind of a gateway drug?
I like to leave that to people to pick, because I mean, sometimes, like, you know, what I like is not necessarily what everybody else likes, but I do really like Closer a lot. I think that's it reminds me, when I heard the demo, it reminded me of a chord progression that I had written for another band, which we'll talk about later, and I immediately loved it. I loved those chords. And so that's one of my favorites. But the whole album's got a great flow to it. It's a really positive, uplifting kind of album, which is good for these days right now, you know?
So currently, like you just did on the intro, Dead Daisies. So you both have Revolution Saints and Dead Daisies going out at the same time. I guess my question there is, how does Revolution Saints kind of get together to record? Is it all, do you actually go into the studio, or is it all kind of remote?
No, we did do the second album. We did together. We tracked it together in Italy in, I guess that was 2016 or so.
Okay.
And, or 15, I can't remember. But, or 17, when it was. But we did do that. But this time, we definitely had different schedules going on. And we basically did it the electronic way, the new way, which is, you know, you'd have a demo, and then you track the drums to the demo, and then the drums come to me and Jack, and we can do our individual parts. And then the guys get together and sing. But the thing is it, it's, that's the only way we can do it when Dean and I are full members of the Dead Daisies, and we're very busy with the Dead Daisies. Revolution Saints isn't, you know, it's a project. It's a session that we do. So we're basically doing this for the, you know, it's a one-off. Each time we do it, you never know if there's going to be another one or not, but we do it for the fans that like the music. And originally, after the first album, we didn't tour or do anything as a real, you know, kind of a band would do. I felt kind of not super excited about doing the second album. But then I got messages from a lot of the fans saying, you know, we really enjoy the music. Some people, like, it really uplifts my day when I'm coming back from work or going to work or whatever. Gives me energy to work out too or something. So I was like, okay, that's cool. I like that, you know. So that's kind of how I justify doing a project when it's not really a band, you know.
Okay. So I guess with that said, you know, the Dead Daisies is a music collective, I guess is the term. But in that situation, at least on Make Some Noise, which is my favorite album of the bunch, it looked like that pretty much everybody wrote together. Would you say that's kind of, for the most part, true? Like all the songs are...
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Okay, so in that situation, are there song ideas that you come up with or you're like, you know, this is just not going to fit for the Dead Daisies and it's better for Revolution Saints?
I don't really think about it too much. I just kind of put ideas down that I like, and then I'll play them for the guys. With the Dead Daisies, I would play riffs. I wouldn't necessarily come up with an entire song, and I definitely wouldn't try and write lyrics for somebody like Glenn Hughes, who is now singing. I send out riffs and maybe some vibes of songs, and if, for example, with Dead Daisies' record, we would all work on it together. There was a song that came out last year called Righteous Days, and I had started some music on that, and Glenn took over with it and did his thing, and David Lowy and Dean, helped with the music as well. So it's really a old-fashioned kind of band. With something like Revolution Saints, the songs are pretty much generated by Alessandro Del Vecchio. He's the fifth Beatle kind of thing, you know. Okay. He's the fourth saint. And so he starts off with some really great musical ideas, and then we kind of go from there, and we'll put in our own two cents, and sometimes we'll change a part here or there, and it becomes a band song. But we're not in the same place writing together or anything like that. I sent a couple of ideas to Jack, and we were working on those, and then we decided we had enough songs like that on the record already, and we put those on ice. And he had a song that he wrote with Tommy Shaw, Eyes of a Child, and we thought that would be a great song to close the album. So we just, you know, as it being a project and we're not together in the same place, you kind of just try and help out with what direction has started and see if you can finish it off.
And the whole, I talked to Karabi earlier this, last year at this point, and at that time he actually was still in the Dead Daisies at that time. And the whole musical collective, now I know it's David Lowy. He basically one day decided he's going to start a band and pretty much grabbed, if I understand right, just grabbed musicians that he wanted to be part of that band, but also kind of that it would be a rotating kind of thing. Is that accurate? An accurate statement?
I think that's kind of the word on the street, but it's actually in reality, it's quite different than that, because David played in a couple of bands in Australia when he was, you know, in his college years, and his dad, you know, wanted him to focus on the family business, which he did, and he put down the guitar for a long while. And then, I don't know when it was exactly, but he formed a band with a singer called John Stevens, and they had been writing and doing gigs in Australia, and I think John Stevens was famous in Australia for being not just a singer, but also like an actor or something. But anyway, okay. They made a band and they needed a name. And John Stevens had been, you know, partying a little too hard one day and went to the doctor. And the doctor said, you better cool it or you're going to end up pushing up Daisy soon, you know, kind of like in the grave. And so that's how they got the name of the Daisies. And then they were looking for musicians to collaborate with. And they started off, somehow they met Marco Mendoza, and Marco knows everybody. If you're going to throw a rock and roll party, just call Marco, because he knows everybody. And David had expressed interest. Actually, he had co-written a song with Slash and John Stevens, and they really liked the direction, you know, that sound of the song is called Lock and Load.
Yep, and, first album, right?
Yeah, and so eventually, you know, John Stevens decided to go his separate ways, and Marco said, hey, by the way, they got Richard Fortus, who had been in Guns N' Roses, and they got Dizzy Reed into the band. They also collaborated with some other guys on doing sessions, Daryl Jones from Stones, and the background singer of the Stones, I'm spacing on his name, but I'll get it in a minute. But anyway, they got a pretty solid lineup with Brian Tichy and Richard Fortus and Dizzy and Marco and David. And then they needed a singer, and they discussed John Karabi. And I didn't even know about the band really until then. John Karabi came in, and I know John since we were in high school. And they came out with the song Midnight Moses, which was really the first time I really took notice of the Dead Daisies. And it was like, this is a cool ass band, you know. And by the way, John Karabi used to play Midnight Moses when he was in a band in Philly when we were kids. And it was like a great song that everyone forgot about through the 80s. In the 70s, it was a big song, you know, in the clubs on the East Coast. And then in the 80s, like, nobody mentioned Alex Harvey Band and that riff. And I thought, Karabi, what a genius to resurrect that riff. for the Dead Daisies. And then somehow or another, you know, Richard Forrest got hurt in a motorcycle accident really badly. And they had asked me would I fill in. I had already committed to Glenn Hughes for a tour, and I said I couldn't. But I passed on a couple names, and they got through their tour. And then eventually Guns N' Roses decided they were getting back together, as you know, in 2016. 16, yes. And that's when I got the call. They said, you know, I know all those guys. We're friends. The only person I didn't know was David. So it was like, and Richard actually said, why don't you get Doug, you know? So it's just kind of a natural thing. So it's not so much like he didn't actually grab as the people as much as Marco said, hey, these guys are cool. I think this would make a good band. And it did. I thought it was a great band with Forrest and Dizzy, and then I felt like Make Some Noise was a, you know, David Lowe really didn't, I mean, he loves Dizzy, don't get me wrong, but he's like heavily into the Australian sound, which is like Rose Tattoo and of course AC/DC and stuff like that. And it's no keyboards. The reason that they had keyboards is because John Stevens, the original singer, wanted keyboards. So they decided, okay, Make Some Noise. Let's bring in Doug, and we're going to have a more guitar-oriented sound. And we wrote together and did that. And it worked out great, you know. And then eventually Brian decided he wanted to do some other stuff. And we went on and we got Dean. You know, I had worked with Dean, and Marco knows Dean really well. So it's just kind of bringing in friends. And it's more, they use the word collective, but it's, there's an old-fashioned word for that, which is how Deep Purple actually started, which is called a roundabout. So it'd basically be like, you know, yeah, come around my house, let's write some songs together. And that's kind of what it was. It was like, who's available? Who can we get to play? Who's around today? And they happened to be in the studio at one point, and Charlie Drayton was in town. They needed a drum track, and Charlie Drayton came in and did the session. It's very 70s-oriented kind of thing, you know. But he didn't necessarily grab the guys as far as like, hey, let's get this guy. Because he obviously could have gotten much more famous people than me to play guitar. I'm just a guy from L.A., and I've been fortunate to play and be in some bands. But it's because of the relationships that we're friends. That's why we were kind of doing it. And that's what we continue to do. I mean, Glenn coming in has been amazing. I'm so excited about the new stuff. But of course, we're missing John and Marco a lot. You know, I mean, I went to the airport to go record the record, and it was so weird to be in an airport without Marco. I'm so used to looking down at the shops and seeing Marco with a bunch of bags in his hand after he went shopping. You know, he's getting ready to go on a tour, and he's shopping at the airport for his clothes. It's awesome. So, but Glenn has come in. He's just killing it. It's definitely he's it's really, really awesome, and I'm super excited for everyone to hear it.
Well, that makes a lot more sense.
Now, at least you got the kind of idea of how it kind of just naturally has progressed, as opposed to there is, like I said, word in the street is you know, David Lowy is a successful businessman. He can afford to basically just grab anybody he wants. But he's also a really talented guitar player. And I say that because, I need to give him credit because, you know, working on this newest record, with Glenn, I put my guitars down first. David was there. We tracked together and it sounded really good. And then I went and cleaned up my guitars and put them down wherever I needed to again. Then David came back and put his guitars back in the mix and fixed up his guitars. And it's like the tracks came alive. It was really cool. He's just got a thing that's a very useful, honest approach to guitar that, you know, a guy like me, I have what I do. That's what I do. I can't play like him. I can't play like, you know, Eddie Van Halen. I can only do what I do. But he definitely adds a sound to the Dead Daisies that doesn't get recognized as much as it probably should. So that's why I wanted to kind of give him props.
No, absolutely. No, I appreciate you going into detail there because there's just a concept that's, that makes a lot more sense as far as the connections and things like that. But it's kind of not the image out there, and so it's a little confusing. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, you know, there's always different aspects to the way bands go and come together. And of course, you want guys that are good, and you want guys that are known, or you want your friends, you know, and it's kind of like, it goes like that. I think for me, I was really enjoying being off the road after I left Whitesnake, and I was just really happy to be home with my son, and just, I was starting a new relationship, and it was all good. And then so all of a sudden, you know, because of friends, I'm like, when Marco called me, I was like, I love Marco. I'll do anything Marco wants to do. So it's like, yeah, I'm in. Let's write a record. Let's see where it goes. I had no idea we'd be as busy as we've been. And you know, now Marco, John decided he wanted to kind of focus on his stuff directly, mostly at the moment. And then Marco as well has really always been, whenever Dead Daisies was off the road, he's always doing solo stuff. Really works really hard.
Dead Daisies is one of the few bands that actually is kind of a, let's just call it supergroup for lack of a better word, that actually works. It's like over the 1%. And now it makes more sense because it's more of a natural development. But I do have one other question on that, and we'll jump to Revolution Saints. And that is that there was a concert that I really wanted to go to but missed, and that was when Whitesnake was touring with the Dead Daisies. Now, I don't have my timeline in front of me. Were you in Whitesnake then or already in the Dead Daisies at that point?
I was in neither at that point.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was I was off the road. I had left Whitesnake and was doing a show with some buddies in Vegas called Raiding the Rock.
Oh, yep.
And in the beginning, that show was really, it was a big production, you know, it was like in a big theater, and they said to me, hey, I was still in Whitesnake when I joined, but when I got there, they said, hey, you can bring your concert rig, and you just, you live in the hotel, you got, you know, these suites that you live in, and food's comp and everything. I was like, this is like a paid vacation to go play guitar for 3 hours a day. I love it. And yeah. And I did it for about a year, but I just got burned out on that. And then I started taking gigs, you know, then Glenn Hughes called me and said, hey, I want to do a tour of just a trio and I want you to play. So then I kind of started doing a few gigs, but I was not in Whitesnake or Dead Daisies. And I heard about that. I thought that's so cool. In fact, I saw them, they went on David Lowy's jet together. Lowy has a jet that he travels because he's basically got, you know, during regular business times, he's got to be all over the world. And then during Dead Daisies times, he also needs to be all over the world. So he's got a way to get there at any time. And so Whitesnake was on the plane. I saw pictures of it. I thought, oh, that's cool. These guys are hanging. And But I would have liked to have seen that show too. It would have been cool. I want, you know, it's kind of, it was cool because like Brian and Marco, who used to be in Whitesnake, and to be supporting Whitesnake was kind of, it would be like a big family, you know?
Gotcha. I thought maybe that was a transition or meeting the guys in the Daisies, but during the tour. But interesting. So you weren't in there, weren't in either band at that time. Okay. I have seen Ray in the Rock Vault. I think that was the time that Dee Snider decided to mention something about that show, if I recall. Yes?
Yeah, he mentioned about me. He's like, you know, this is, well, why is this guy up on a billboard? You know, isn't he Whitesnake? Isn't he? And I was in Whitesnake at the time, or I had just recently left. But he's a nice guy, I'm sure. He just made a comment, and I just wanted to put it straight that, you know, I had been in Whitesnake for a long time and co-written a lot of songs, and we would perform those songs live, and I should be allowed to use the Whitesnake name. A lot of people, you know, only know Whitesnake from the current lineup. You know, like there's a lot of kids that are discovering Whitesnake, and they only know Whitesnake. Their only guitar player they know is Joel Hoekstra and Red Beach. They don't know about me. They don't know about Sykes. They don't know about Bernie Marsden. So now Red's been in the band 20 years or whatever. I mean, he's, even though he's not an original member, he should be able to use that he's from Whitesnake. So I just was saying that. So, but anyway, it was all good. There was another little side story to that too, is that Karabi and Dee used to have Bruce Kulick used to have a show in Vegas called Monster Circus, and it was kind of a similar thing. With a different song list, and it didn't.
I would have loved to see that.
Yeah, it was Bruce Kulick on guitar, John Karabi singing and playing guitar. Dee would come in. He was kind of the superstar of that lineup, I think. And it went on for a little while, and then it faded away, and then Raiding the Rock Vault came, and I think it may have been a little bit of a thorn in those guys' sides. You know, me and Karabi talked about it a lot, and but John Karabi is, he's so non-confrontational about everything. He's just like, whatever, man, it was cool. You know, we had our show, and you guys had that show. But as I said, after a year of doing that show, being in Vegas, I got severely burned out, and I needed to start writing and doing stuff. And that's, like I said, that's when I started to look at, you know, some offers that were coming in. Dead Daisies was one of them. And I'm full-time Daisies. And then stuff like Revolution Saints comes around now and again. It's really fun to do Revolution Saints because it's a different style of music that, I think, you know, a lot of people miss it, and we happen to do it pretty good, and so works out. You know, it's a session, and we can get people some music that they like to, you know, uplift their day.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely uplifting music. One other thing, too, is I'm sure you're familiar with the movie Hired Gun, correct?
Yes.
Would you consider, you know, you've had such an interesting career where you've been in Dio, you've been in Whitesnake. You know, you're always an active musician. Is that a term that you like? Would you consider yourself in that zone? Would you be good to be in that movie, for example?
I wouldn't have done it myself just because I didn't ever consider myself a hired gun, really. I mean, there have been situations where, I was in Dio, and when I was in Dio, it was the band Dio. I was the guitar player, and I co-wrote and recorded with the band. Sometimes in a hired gun situation, you're just hired to go on tour. You didn't even play on a record, you know, other times, just to elaborate a little bit, sometimes you did play on the record, but you didn't write the songs. With Whitesnake, me and David co-wrote 30 songs together, and we played those songs live, and he had the band on hiatus, and he got me and Reb and Marco and Tommy to, you know, restart, to, you know, to bring the band back. And so we worked hard and we toured and did stuff. And as I told David, look, if we're going to take this further, we need some new music. And then we started writing. And so I never, you know, I could have felt like a hired gun for the first tours of Whitesnake, but I I definitely, but after I left and when Hired Gun movie came out, I was definitely a full member of Whitesnake during that time, and I was David Coverdale's partner. And that's something that I'm really proud of, you know, that we created a lot of music together. Of course, record sales are not what they were in the 80s. In fact, with the records that I wrote with David, they sold a lot more than probably records sell now, because every year it gets less and less. But yeah, I'd never consider myself a hired gun. Some people might say that's differently, but if you're writing and recording and involved in, you know, every aspect of making sure that the band moves forward, that's different than just David Coverdale calling me going, okay, we're going to tour. Are you available? It's like, there was no question I was available. I was in Whitesnake. I was working with him 24/7, even when the band was off the road. So, but I, at the same time, I think Hired Gun is a cool movie and I liked it. I thought it was pretty interesting. You know, it's a different time. You know, a lot of those guys in that movie are younger than me and
right.
They're really great musicians and that's how they got noticed. And for me, I mean, to be really honest, I was self-taught. It took me a long time to be able to do something that I felt good about, that I was proud of. And then once I did, I did it the old-fashioned way. I went and got a band together, and we hit the clubs, and we played as much as we could and rehearsed every night and didn't have any money. And, you know, little by little, years and years and years and years, finally I got a break. And but the Lion was a huge, I mean, even with Lion, that was like a hard road, man. We worked our asses off and we didn't get, you know, that much. We definitely didn't make any money, really. We were able to kind of get through, but I was teaching guitar at the same time, but I have no regrets about it. It's just the way I was. I worked hard because I loved it. I mean, look, if I forget what band it was, Alice Cooper. If Alice Cooper calls up, say for example,
sure,
a guitar player that maybe a guy that's not that well known, but maybe known in his area, but he's known as being a really great guitar player, or even he doesn't have a band. Maybe he's just online and he does videos online or something. And Alice Cooper calls up and goes, "Hey man, I want you to be my lead guitar player, and I'm going to feature you on the road. And I'm going to pay you, you know, $5,000 a week or whatever it is." That's cool. Nothing wrong with that. That may lead into something where they collaborate and write music, and you know. But maybe you'd start as a hired gun, but you'd end up as a producer, you know, or something. So you never know. But I like that movie.
Okay, cool. Yeah, in your case, you end up being in a more collaborative situation every single time. Part of that.
Well, the only one that people might have said would be Whitesnake, really. I mean, because when I got hired to do that, it was like that kind of situation. It was like, hey, you're in Dio. And I said, I'm in Dio. I got Dio, and Dio's going off, taking a break. And basically, David said, no problem. I'm only going to do 2 months. It's just a tour. And that, I guess, in all technicality, then I was a hired gun at that point. But it was such a short amount of time before David and I just kind of sparked, and we actually extended that tour by 9 months. And he said, "Look, you got to decide: are you going to stay in Dio, or are you going to be a snake full time?" And so that's kind of, you know, what happened. But I love playing guitar stuff. If Elton John or whoever said, "Hey man, would you come?" You know, I do sessions for people, so that would be a hired gun. I played on a Lady Gaga record once. That's definitely a hired gun situation.
Okay, so you got blended both for Revolution Saints. Now, you know, you're busy with the Daisies and things like that. Is there any plans on? Is there going to be any time to actually tour?
Not really, no, because
okay.
Dead Daisies is full time. We're just getting geared up. We're finishing the record, then we're starting. We're going to basically got a few surprises too that are going to be announced soon that we'll be doing in April that are really extravagant traveling in terms of distances. Oh, okay. And it's coming out. It'll come out. But
And then we're starting our tour. And we've got, you know, brand new lineup, and it's like a fresh start. We gotta be full on, all in, and which we are. So, and to be honest, I've explained this to a few people, like, you know, a band like Night Ranger, if Jack goes off and does a month tour, you know, it might make it difficult for Night Ranger to go back to some of those areas, just because it does affect ticket sales. If they see, like, for example, if I go and do a tour with Revolution Saints, when I go back, some Dead Daisies people will be like, hey, I already saw Doug, you know, I'm not going to go. And for Jack, there's so many more fans, and also, you know, Night Ranger's got a lot of people that it supports. I mean, probably 50 people, 50 families earn their living from Night Ranger, maybe. And
right,
they can't afford to have Jack Blades going off on tour. And the Dead Daisies employs a lot of people. So, you know, I'm not ready to step down from the Dead Daisies, so I want to be there, you know?
So for Revolution's End, you know, you heard back from a lot of fans and said, okay, if people like this, I want to do more, I'm encouraged to do more. So when you're looking at that, and like you said, it is your side project, what would you look at as a measure of success for, because you're not touring with it and things like that, like as far as expected streams, or what are you looking for exactly?
I'm just basically looking for people to like it and maybe have, you know, have it affect them in a good way somehow. I mean, with a project like that, basically, you're not doing it so much for the money. There's a budget to make the record. And so you get paid for your time, and you know, some of us wrote a little bit here and there on the records. But then that's it. So without a tour, there's no real income. And so of course you want as many people to hear it and see it as possible. But the thing that really makes it worthwhile is when somebody says, man, I really, that record just, that's my favorite record of all the ones you've done or whatever. Maybe it's, you know, like I say, it's a different style of music than what's happening at the moment. It's kind of a throwback to the 80s, which is,
right.
You know, there's a lot of bands doing it, but we have a good sound. It's kind of a unique sound that we have. It's kind of a mix of you know, a band like Journey and Whitesnake and Night Ranger. You know, it's kind of got those flavors to it, which is what the record company wanted. And so it's fun to do, you know, that stuff. Because it's with a band like the Dead Daisies, we go in a totally different direction. That's, you know, going back to our roots more than back to the 80s. So, and then that becomes whatever it's going to sound like, you know. But I hope that people enjoy it. I hope it inspires some people. And one of the biggest compliments that I think, you know, somebody said, as I mentioned, was it makes me feel like I want to work out. I want to get in shape. And when I listen to that music, I work harder. And that's really cool.
Yeah, so I'll give you some of that feedback there that you like, and that is that absolutely Rise and Higher, those two tracks that got me right out the gate, those improved my mood and made me smile. So is that some of that success you're looking for?
Yes, that is. That's very good. I'm glad to hear that, and I hope, you know, other people feel the same way.
Well, thank you, Doug. I appreciate it very much.
All right, Dan. Thank you, brother. Really appreciate your time, and look forward to hopefully meeting you down the road this year.
Absolutely. I will hopefully. So Dead Daisies has maybe a U.S. tour planned?
Yes. Yeah, we do. I'm not sure what the markets are, but we're going exactly yet. But, I haven't looked at any of the tour dates yet. I just know that starting in March, we're going to be in rehearsals, and I'll figure out the rest later.
Excellent. Well, I hope there's a Denver stop in there.
I hope so, too, because we haven't been there. At least not since
really?
I'm in the band. So, nope. I hope so, too.
You can go check out the mountain.
Absolutely. I would love to. You know, I actually just took my family skiing, and we had such a blast. And my wife is from Germany, and she's like, is this, like, the biggest mountain in the U.S.? I'm like, this California hill? This is not even the Rocky Mountain.
Yeah.
You know, she's used to skiing in the Alps and stuff like that. And I'm like, this is just a hill in California. It's not like the Rocky Mountains. You got to go to Vail or one of those places, Aspen.
That's right. You have an excuse to get out here. But thank you, Doug. I appreciate it very much. And again, Revolution Saints, rise out this January. Thank you, sir.
Sounds good. Sounds good, brother. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey,
I'm back.
Sorry about that.
No, not a problem at all. I get it. Hey, before we get started, I did want to kiss up to you just a little bit. In 85, I started playing guitar. I think I was 14, and it was you and Jake Ely were like basically 1A and 1B for me. And I talked to Jake about a year ago on the program. So for what it's worth, this is kind of a big deal for me. I'll try to keep it together.
Oh, man.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.